Today, if not V-shaped, then what? The DFA Daily is the 22nd of May, 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's edition, we look at the recent economic data and Treasury commentary on the economy and discuss the trajectory of recovery and its implications. And before we start, a couple of reminders. On Sunday, there's an online seminar with Harry Dent and Robert Kiyosaki and myself discussing the current economic challenges facing Australia. You can still sign up by going to harrydentlive.com. And towards the end of the day, there will be a Q&A session with Harry and myself, which I think should be quite interesting. And next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney time, there's a DFA live stream event with property insider Edwin Almeida, where you can ask us questions via the live chat, or you can send questions in beforehand via the DFA blog. I think this will be a very lively session, so I'll see you there. And so to the news. Australia has gone well past the word recession and faces a drawn-out recovery, Treasury boss Stephen Kennedy has warned. Although the earlier-than-expected easing of restrictions provides cause for optimism, Dr. Kennedy told a parliamentary hearing on Thursday that the economy would not snap back to normal anytime soon. Dr. Kennedy said, taking into account the number of people who stopped looking for jobs in April, as well as the effects of the JobKeeper wage subsidy, the true unemployment rate is much closer to 15% than the 6.2% officially recorded last week. We have 720,000 people who are being paid but not working any hours. They have not withdrawn their labour, but the extent to which our workers are underemployed is substantial, he said. And as reported in the New Daily, Dr. Kennedy said that the headline jobless rate was likely to rise in step with the easing of restrictions and reach a peak in May or June as more people start looking for work and consequently meet the ABS definition of unemployed. But the response to the health crisis has been better than he and his Treasury colleagues anticipated. Dr. Kennedy said he was therefore a bit more optimistic about the economy today than when he advised the government on its economic stimulus measures, though ongoing fiscal support will be crucial as there won't be any more cuts in interest rates coming down the track, he said. The pandemic was hurting the economy in four key areas. Firstly, social distancing and other containment measures have forced businesses to close. The closure of schools is reducing productivity as parents juggling childcare and work. The economic crisis has reduced global demand for our exports, and the twin health and economic crises have weighed on consumer demand and confidence in Australia. The demand confidence effect is the one that is really hard to predict, he said, and that's the one that tells you whether you're going to get a V or a U-shaped economic recovery. Senator Jackie Lambie later asked Dr. Kennedy whether Treasury had provided advice to the government on reducing the job seeker rate and targeting JobKeeper at specific industries after the policies expire in September. And Dr. Kennedy said Treasury is monitoring how the scheme works and will consider both issues during its three-month review. There is some trick in it, Senator. As soon as you get into targeting either by a threshold or by a sector, then you have a lot of messiness around the edge. Which sectors are in and which sectors are out? And just exactly how things apply, he said. And then administratively, you just have to be able to administer the arrangement. But in terms of if sectors were recovering strongly and others weren't, that would be a very relevant consideration for the review of JobKeeper that we're doing at the moment. And he said the end of certain fiscal policies in September was not quite the cliff it looked like, as cash advances given to businesses would sit on company balance sheets beyond the withdrawal of JobKeeper. Like interest rate cuts, fiscal policy operates with a lag and actually builds over 4 to 6 quarters, he said. A strong recovery is nonetheless dependent on a pickup in housing, and business investment, an area that Dr. Kennedy said Treasury will watch very carefully. And the Deputy Secretary of Treasury Fiscal Group later confirmed that 1.65 million Australians have withdrawn more than $13.2 billion from their superannuation under the Coalition's Early Access Scheme, while the government has so far paid out $8.1 billion in JobKeeper payments. And the committee hearing comes after Deloitte Access Economics said unemployment is unlikely to fall back to pre-crisis levels until 2024, and in a new discussion paper released on Friday, left-leaning think tank Per Capita argues that Australia was suffering from stubbornly high levels of underemployment even before the arrival of COVID-19. Researcher Matthew Lloyd Cape said that the steep rise in underemployment triggered by the virus would cost the economy $24 billion a year in lost wages and have lasting effects known as economic scarring. For example, he said, the incomes of low-income earners in the USA fell by 20% during the 1980-82 recession and did not return to their pre-recession level until the late 1990s. And earlier in the week, the ABS released preliminary data on Australian retail turnover, which fell 17.9% in April 2020, seasonally adjusted. This is the strongest seasonally adjusted fall ever published from the Retail Trade Survey, following the strongest ever seasonally adjusted rise in March. Turnover was down 9.4% when compared to April 2019. These preliminary figures, which will be subject to revision, show falls in every industry, with particularly strong falls in food retailing, cafes, restaurants and takeaways, and clothing, footwear and personal accessories. The fall in seasonally adjusted terms in April 2020 was driven by the food retailing industry, which fell 17.1% in April, following a 24.1% rise in March. Sales in food retailing are 5% above the level of April 2019. Analysis of supermarket and grocery store scanner data shows that monthly retail turnover fell in original terms from non-perishable goods, perishable goods, and all other products by 23.7%, 15.3%, and 24.5% respectively in April 2020. These falls follow significant unprecedented demand in March 2020, where non-perishable goods rose 39%, perishable goods rose 21.6%, and all other products rose 30.5%. The April month saw further strong falls in cafes, restaurants and takeaway food services, and clothing, footwear and personal accessories retailing. And businesses reported that regulations regarding social distancing measures limited their ability to trade as normal for the entire month. Turnover in clothing, footwear and personal accessories and cafes, restaurants and takeaways in April 2020 is around half the level of April 2019. And April also saw a strong result for online retailing, with 10% of total retail turnover purchased online. One reason why we think on-the-ground retail may never recover. But we also need to look beyond the current to the future. The Daily Mail featured some important discussion and quoted some of my work. They wrote, Australia has a golden opportunity to set up the nation for the next 30 years by spending its way out of the coronavirus crisis, economists have said. The biggest threat to the nation since World War II has created a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to restructure the economy. Australia has become too dependent on housing construction, fueled by a giant mortgage debt bubble and unsustainable mass migration, according to three leading economists. Economist Martin North said the time is right for the government to splash out on strategic infrastructure projects to create thousands of jobs, saving the country from a potential depression. It's a huge opportunity if people could see it, he told Daily Mail Australia. We have to take a strategic view. Interest rates are low, and the government has the ability to borrow big. We need to capitalise on that and don't worry about the budget being balanced. Mr. North said that there were plenty of useful projects to create the jobs needed to help Australia out of the coronavirus downturn, including irrigation and sewer system upgrades. We need proper infrastructure, high-speed rail, water projects to make the country sustainable. Green energy, he said. And Mr. North said Australia just has to accept it's been hit by a 1-in-100-year storm and that the budget will not be balanced for a long time. Australia's government debt level is only around 30% of GDP, which is low compared to Japan's, which hit 238% of GDP in 2018. Interest rates have never been as low as now. And from a debt servicing perspective, we have the capacity to get more funds, he said. And Mr. North said now was the time to invest in solid nation-building infrastructure that would set the groundwork for the next 30 years of Australia's future. However, Mr. North said he feared the government would be pressurised to prop up old economic distortions such as the over-reliance on housing construction, which fuelled a housing price bubble and unsustainable mass migration. We can't just go back to pre-COVID days. It would be a major mistake, he said. If we go backwards, we will just create problems for ourselves. It needs to create the greatest good for the greatest number of people, not just support the construction sector. And my worry is they'll try to buy back half-built constructions and houses in negative equity and not make the strategic restructure. Mr. North warned that the construction sector has been lobbying for mass migration levels to prop up the sector despite the pandemic. And indeed, the HIA said their new forecasts say new home building will fall by almost 50%, putting 500,000 jobs at risk over the next year. In 2018-19, the industry engaged over 1 million people to commence building almost 200,000 new homes. Next year, we expect to start just 112,000 new homes, leaving up to 500,000 jobs at risk, said HIA's Managing Director, Graham Wolfe. The shock to the economy from the halting of overseas migration, the absence of student arrivals, and uncertainty over the domestic economy will see the market at a lower point in December 2020 than it was during the 1990s recession. It will then continue to decline through 2021, even with the return of overseas students and migration. This shock will reverberate through the residential building industry, up and down the supply chain. Employment in the sector is not expected to recover within the next 2 years. The loss of the international students and migration creates a temporary imbalance in demand for rental accommodation. The 625,000 overseas students enrolled in Australian education institutions equates to demand for the past 2 years of apartment construction. And it is not clear how many of these left in March or how many will return. For the past 20 years, Australia's economic growth has been underscored by stable population growth. The nature of this shock requires significant and ongoing support from policymakers in Australia and amongst our trading partners. The risk is that insufficient support will produce a decade of deflation, depression, and human hardship. This means that of all the concerns facing government right now, debt should not be at the top of the list. JobKeeper plays a very important role in supporting workers directly impacted by industry shutdowns. The building industry has been fortunate to continue to operate. Many small builders will not be eligible for the program as the downturn will impact the sector most significantly from September 2020, when the majority of projects under construction are completed. Restarting the economy and allowing students to return are also necessary steps to a full recovery. Drawing forward housing demand can also play a role in alleviating the emerging shock to new home construction and the wider economy. Traditionally, Australia has done this through empowering consumers to build new homes, with the caveat that there is a high degree of uncertainty around the outlook. The disruption to migration and the elevated rate of unemployment will weigh heavily on demand for residential building beyond 2020. In financial year terms, dwelling starts in 2019-20 are now expected to be down by 18.3% compared to 1819, and starts are forecast to decline by a further 30.5% in 2021. If this transpires, the commencement of new homes will have fallen nearly 43% from last year to next, concluded Mr. Wolf. And Shane Wright at The Age wrote that buyers of freshly built homes could be given a $50,000 check from the government under a $2.5 billion plan from the Property Council to kickstart the economy amid Reserve Bank warnings the housing sector faces an extended period of pain. The council also wants the abolition of stamp duty, the broadening of the GST, and a welcome migration campaign aimed at luring foreigners to Australia. On Wednesday, the group said without change, the residential sector would weigh on the economy in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. And the Property Council believes a $50,000 grant to people buying a new home would help kickstart construction and the broader economy. Home builders have already reported contract cancellation rates of more than 30% since the shutdown of key parts of the economy to prevent the spread of the virus. While the construction sector, which employs more than 1.1 million people, has shed at least 5% of its workforce since March. Council Chief Executive Ken Morrison said bold policies were needed to get the economy, expected to shrink by 10% in the June quarter, restarted, with the housing sector a key element in the recovery. As Australia's biggest employer, which contributes over 13% of GDP, the property industry can be a powerhouse behind economic recovery and growth with the right policy settings and market initiatives from the federal, state and territory governments, he said. At the heart of the proposals is a $50,000 new home boost for buyers of new housing, which the council estimates would stimulate the construction of 50,000 dwellings and support 200,000 jobs. It would dwarf the $21,000 in grants that were available to first-time owners who bought new builds during the global financial crisis under the Rudd government stimulus program. The program would run for 12 months and be limited to 50,000 properties, while there would be no cap on the value of the home. The council is also calling for major tax changes to support the sector, including the removal of state stamp duty and its replacement through a broadened base of GST. Only four large areas, including fresh food, education and health, are excluded from the GST. And the Morrison government is expecting net migration numbers to collapse this financial year and next due to, in large part, the restrictions on global border movements. And minutes of the RBA's latest meeting show continuing concern about falling activity in the property sector. So the council wants a Welcome to Australia migration plan that would include a major advertising campaign to promote the country as a safe and healthy destination. And it argues that the current point system for skilled migration should be temporarily lowered and people encouraged to live in major capitals as well as regional centres. Housing construction and the property sector is growing as an issue for the Reserve Bank, which noted in the minutes of its most recent meeting that a drop in employment, incomes and wealth will have a direct impact on general consumer spending. And the minutes released last Tuesday showed building companies are already reporting a drop in demand for new and established housing, while cash-strapped Australians are moving back in with their parents or share houses. Lower incomes and confidence, as well as lower expected population growth, were expected to affect demand for new housing for an extended period, the minutes showed. And there are also concerns about the commercial property sector, with rents in the major capitals expected to fall, with many businesses having staff working from home rather than CBDs. And the economic uncertainty are hitting new businesses too. For example, Volt Bank is delaying the launch of its loan product to ensure its foray into lending is done in a very prudent way, but it expects to launch its mortgage offering to the broker channel by the end of the year. The FinTech lender, which became the first organisation to be granted a restricted ADI licence in 2018 before gaining its full licence last year, has revealed that the coronavirus outbreak and its associated market disruption has led the bank to delay the launch of lending products, which were scheduled to be released from the middle of this year. As well as delaying the launch, the neobank also outlined that it intends to make mortgages rather than personal loans its first credit product on market. Speaking to The Advisor, Vault Bank's co-founder and CEO Steve Weston elaborated, "Initially, we said that we would first launch personal loans, both secured and unsecured, and then we would do mortgages, and then we would do small business loans. But when you look at previous economic hiccups, the first area that is hit is unsecured lending, things like personal loans, credit cards, and unsecured business loans. Typically, looking at previous credit track records is very helpful when assessing a borrower's capacity to repay a loan. But in an environment like we're seeing now, even people with the most unblemished credit record may default if they don't have a job," he said. "As we are starting with a clean balance sheet that doesn't have any bad debts, which incumbent banks are going to need to work through as a result of COVID-19, that is an enormous asset for Vault and something we want to protect," Mr. Weston continued. "So it's not prudent for someone like Vault to make its first step into lending to be unsecured given the current market. Our first foray into the lending market needs to be done in a very prudent way. So it really is from a prudent perspective that, given the current environment, our first entry into lending will be secured by property as opposed to unsecured." And according to the mortgage veteran, who has previously held roles as GM of NAB's broker platforms and CEO of mortgages at Barclays UK, Vault is in no rush to start lending, but will wait until the time is right, potentially by the end of the calendar year. "We have all of our deposit products well progressed, and we want to be in a position that we can launch them to the public and build up the deposit funds to start lending when the time is right," he told The Advisor. "While we're going to be positioned and right to go later this year, it will depend on the market conditions for when we will do that. Until we know what is happening with the virus, to go out and start lending today doesn't make sense for a startup." And the CEO added that the bank would look to break into unsecured lending once it is more comfortable with the market. And Philip Lowe, RBA governor, in remarks to the FINSIA online forum, made four key points. The first is that the Australian financial system is resilient and is well placed to deal with COVID-19. In particular, the system has large capital and liquidity buffers, and it has made substantial investments in operational resilience. The system is in this strong position partly because over the past decade, APRA has worked with financial institutions to boost their capital and to reduce their liquidity risks. Australia's financial institutions are also profitable, and they have had low levels of problem loans. The second point, he said, is that the capital and liquidity buffers that exist are available to be drawn upon if required to support the economy. And he wanted to reinforce that point. If there was ever a time to allow those buffers to be used, now is that time. We should not expect to see capital buffers being maintained during a once-in-a-century shock. These buffers have been built up to be utilised in events such as this, and some reduction in capital ratios is entirely appropriate as lenders support their customers through this difficult period. The third and related point is that it is important that lenders continue to support the flow of credit to the economy. They are committed to assisting this process, and the Reserve Bank, through its package of policy measures, is doing what it can to keep funding costs low and credit available. And the government has granted a six-month exemption from responsible lending obligations when lenders provide credit to existing customers who run a small business. Consistent with this, ASIC has been encouraging lenders to work closely with their customers to provide short-term assistance and support their longer-term viability. And APRA announced temporary changes to its expectations regarding bank capital ratios. And the fourth and final point is that the regulatory agencies have been conscious of the need to adjust the timing of their regulatory initiatives, where possible, to allow financial institutions to focus on serving their customers. In the case of the RBA, we have put on hold the review of retail payments regulation, which we started last year. While we continue to do work in the background, the review will not be completed until next year. Now, there was also some discussion on negative rates, and Lowe ruled out the possibility of negative rates being deployed in Australia, saying the policy would not benefit the economy. This is significant given the broader discussion among central bankers worldwide. For example, Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey told British Parliament on Wednesday that negative rates were under active review, and that is a significant shift from the previous week when Mr. Bailey said the central bank was not planning or contemplating that move. And in New Zealand, Adrian Orr confirmed that the Reserve Bank of New Zealand was considering a negative official cash rate as an option in the future. But on Thursday, Mr. Lowe dismissed the possibility of Australia's official cash rate falling below zero. I've said previously that it was extraordinarily unlikely that we would have negative interest rates, and there's been no change to that thinking, Dr. Lowe noted. The Reserve Bank Board is not contemplating having negative interest rates in Australia. I think the cost of that exceeds the benefits. Australia's official cash rate is a record low of 0.25%, and it could be there for years. Dr. Lowe's comments followed a speech from the Deputy Governor of the Bank of Canada, Timothy Lane, which revealed the country's central bankers had drawn a similar conclusion. He said that he didn't think negative policy rates were advisable since they can interfere with banking system function. And the ANZ economist said that the BOC viewed 0.25% as an effective lower bound. And in the US, minutes from the last Federal Open Market Committee meeting released this week showed that the prospect did not rate a mention amongst members, following on from Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell's comments last week that they were not a policy tool under consideration. But of course, the Eurozone and Japan, where rates have been lower for longer, are already there. So my view remains it's a matter of time before we see it here. And finally, this from Credit Suisse. Uncertainty in the housing market is elevated. There are many views in the market as to where house prices are heading. Some commentators believe that house prices will fall by double digits, while others believe that they could rise moderately. Notwithstanding the dispersion of views, all economists are wrestling with the idea that Australia's borders will remain closed for an extended period of time, even when local shutdown restrictions are relaxed. Closure matters a lot for Australian housing at present because migration makes up the lion's share of population growth, and strong population growth is needed to fuel household formation at a time when heavy supply of new builds is coming onto the market. In truth, though, border closures are soft rather than hard. Foreigners can still come to Australia, provided they have approval from authorities and are willing to quarantine themselves for 14 days after arrival. Arguably, Australia is still open for business. As such, there is uncertainty about how onerous restrictions really are on population growth and household formation. Also, there is uncertainty around how many forced sales of existing homes could come to the market. After all, listings are well down, supporting high auction clearance rates despite rather low levels of turnover. And in principle, with unemployment rising sharply, one would expect listings of foreclosure homes to be higher. But clearly, debt repayment holidays and government cash handouts via the JobKeeper program are confounding factors. Abstracting from news flow views and anecdotes, there are several objective ways to measure uncertainty in the housing market. One approach is to calculate the rolling volatility of national house price inflation. But inevitably, this measure will provide a lagging indicator because the most commonly followed house price indicators are measured on hedonic settlement bases. That is, diversity among homes being bought and sold are artificially stripped out using mathematical techniques. And prices are recorded more than a month after transactions because of contract settlement delays. With all of this in mind, we prefer, he says, to look at the dispersion of housing sentiment indicators across the country, allowing for both time series and cross-sectional variations, because housing is cyclical and is not a homogeneous asset class. Put differently, housing investors feel uncertainty about how the housing cycle is evolving, as well as about how representative national housing indices might be for the particular segments of the market they're invested in. Now, they measure sentiment using the Westpac survey of consumers reporting whether or not it is a good or bad time to purchase a dwelling. Ideally, they would use house price inflation expectations by state, but long-time series at the disaggregated level are not available. And they feel that home buying sentiment would be a reasonable proxy for this missing information, as it correlates well with affordability and demand, and therefore should provide a leading signal on prices. And so they say, a housing uncertainty gauge is calculated the rolling three-month dispersion of home buying sentiment across the states, and it's comparable to equity market volatility and swaption pricing for bonds. And at present, housing uncertainty is elevated, but is not at historically high levels. High uncertainty is a sufficient building block for portfolio construction because Australian households are risk parity investors. Risk parity investing is based on the idea of equalising risk contributions across components of one's portfolio and using leverage to achieve desired returns at lower risk. It means leveraging up on the lowest risk asset classes as an efficient form of investing. For multi-asset investors, this strategy means overweighting bonds relative to equities and commodities, because sovereign bonds generally have the lowest volatility of all the major asset classes, and grossing up the portfolio by around 30% to achieve equity-like returns with bond-like volatility. The risk parity strategy is an incredibly elegant one, effectively premised on predictability, lower for longer rates, and lower for longer volatility. Australian households and their investors might not explicitly pursue risk parity strategies in managing the superannuation or voluntary saving, but they implicitly use risk parity in their portfolio allocation because they are heavily overweight housing as their perceived lowest risk asset class, and use a lot of leverage to achieve this positioning. On the flip side, a sharp and sudden increase in the risk profile of housing has the potential to upset this positioning and wrong-foot housing investors, prompting de-risking and deleveraging. For this reason, we are less interested in forecasting the direction and magnitude of house price movements and more interested in understanding volatility and risks of the asset class. Indeed, they say, we think that the fact of elevated housing uncertainty by itself goes a long way towards successful portfolio construction in related universes, and this is even before testing what housing might look like in an environment with more volatility rates and geopolitics. And they say that housing credit growth is going nowhere, but there is caution about the compositional shift. The latest available credit aggregates from the Reserve Bank of Australia reveal that overall housing credit growth is steady at around 0.3% over the month. But within its number, they note rather large compositional shift. Owner-occupied housing growth is picking up, while investor housing credit is shrinking. And they think that this profile of growth is very consistent with policy developments and the heightened state of uncertainty in the market. Loan approvals data ironically sheds light on repayment activity. And by definition, credit growth equals new loans, less refinancing and repayments. And we know what new home demand and refinance activity is like from the Australian Bureau of Statistics housing finance approvals data. And we know what credit growth is doing from RBA aggregates. Therefore, they say, we can back out net repayments from the available data. Moreover, because both the ABS and RBA now publish the breakdown of housing finance, refinance and credit data according to owner, occupiers and investors, it's also possible to decompose net repayment estimates according to these categories. Owner-occupied principal payments are down and investor principal payments are up. And the detailed data reveals that owner-occupied net mortgage principal payments fell 14% in March to $8.4 billion from $9.8 billion in February. The fall in repayments is broadly consistent with data from the Australian Bankers Association, showing that 429,000 mortgages amounting to $154 billion of credit have been deferred, roughly equivalent to one out of 14 mortgages. But on the flip side, investor net principal payments rose 14% in March to $5.7 billion from $5 billion in February. Overall principal payments fell slightly, with investors offsetting the behaviours of owner-occupiers. Actually, housing investors are behaving entirely rationally. Historically, housing market uncertainty leads the rate of investor mortgage principal repayments by several months. The correlations support the idea that Australians are indeed risk parity investors. When it comes to housing, the more risky housing becomes as an asset class, the more investors pay down their mortgages to reduce their leveraged exposure. And now that housing volatility is elevated, many investors are getting wrong-footed in their positioning and are responding rationally by de-risking and deleveraging their housing portfolios. Accordingly, investor principal payments are rising and are likely to continue to rise in the foreseeable future. And debt relief for distressed owner-occupiers is unlikely to materially inflate the stock of housing credit in the light of investor behaviour pulling in the opposite direction. And should loan approvals start to weaken in response to tighter funding conditions as well, credit growth should outright slow. And they say, timing-wise, it is distinctly possible that the slowing in private sector credit growth occurs at exactly the same time that fiscal deficit spending tapers off. Now, that's not necessarily a disaster, but policymakers need to somehow keep a lid on volatility. It's possible that debt relief, the plunge in listings, and thinly liquid conditions in the housing market might obfuscate price discovery in the market, perversely limiting measured house price volatility. But if policymakers were to rely on these factors to cut off deleveraging risks, they would essentially be banking on hope as a strategy, hope that the constraints from COVID-19 might disappear quickly enough to enable a full reopening of the economy, even the borders, so as to strengthen the claim that oversupply in the housing market is temporary and to give participants reason to hold out for a while longer. They will be putting all of their eggs in one basket. And so they say, we think that more stimulus needs to come through, or at least be advertised, to keep the housing market near its unhappy equilibrium. But monetary policy is largely tapped out now that the bank has cut rates to 0.25% and is in the phase of actively managing its quantitative easing program. Another tempting option is to softly reopen the borders, although they say we suspect government officials will think long and hard about the risks, having failed the first time to prevent COVID-19 from reaching Australian shores and having inflicted significant damage on the economy through its shutdown response. The nuclear option is to somehow use the public sector's balance sheet to support the housing market, whether directly through purchases or indirectly through generous loan guarantees and subsidies. Alternatively, policymakers could allow market forces to run their course. And there you have, in a nutshell, the critical issue that we face. My worry is that policymakers will run and pursue homes and home prices as one of the primary levers of recovery. But as I said at the outset, that would be a mistake. We have to let property market prices settle, and we have to focus on long-term investment into the future of Australia, as I argued at the start. And if we do that, then whilst we won't get a V-shaped recovery, we can certainly get a U-shaped recovery. But more importantly, we can actually build a foundation for the future and take Australia in a different direction. The last thing that we should be doing is throwing all the eggs in the housing debt basket once again. That didn't work a decade ago, and it won't work now. And if we do that, we would miss the opportunity for fundamental and strategic change. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.